A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is a tennis podcast we weren't expecting to do because it's Wednesday. We normally do them on Mondays unless we're at Grand Slams. But a little bit like when Maria Sharapova told the world that she had a big announcement to make and we all watched a live internet stream with a countdown until she stood in front of some curtains to tell us that she'd tested positive for meldonium 4 years ago, almost to the day, in fact, 4 years ago. It was in the first week of March in 2016. We have, out of the blue, discovered today that Maria Sharapova is announcing her retirement. Now, 4 years ago, that's what we thought she was about to do, and then she revealed that she tested positive. So that led to a suspension, eventually a comeback, and not a very successful comeback, one that has been full of injuries and not a great sight at times, really, as she struggled to try to get back into the game and do some of the things she'd done before. And let's not forget, she'd won 5 Grand Slam titles, including all 4 of the Grand Slams, winning Wimbledon at the age of 17 in 2004. So Catherine Whittaker and myself are here at your disposal for a little chat about all of it. Catherine, that it was a bit of a shock and a bit out of the blue, although I suppose not really that much of a shock when you really look at the facts of the matter, that Maria Sharapova hasn't been a factor in such a long time.
Yeah, and when you proposed that we record an emergency podcast about it, my first thought was, can we dig out the one that we recorded 4 years ago?
We did actually do one,
didn't we? We've already done a Maria Sharapova retirement podcast because she called that press conference in LA and we were scheduled to record our usual pod at the Putney Exchange that day. And we knew that later that day this press conference was happening. We thought it's probably going to be retirement, so we'd better do a Maria Sharapova retirement podcast.
Wow, I'd forgotten that.
It was probably our very best work that never went to air.
Yeah, it's way better than this. But anyway,
so here we are doing a second Maria Sharapova retirement podcast. She'd better bloody well not do a comeback because I'm not doing another one.
Okay, well, so we'll talk about Maria Sharapova ourselves in a minute or two. But let's hear, first of all, from the man that broke the story today. We first saw a tweet about Maria Sharapova's retirement from Christopher Clary, who's been a regular guest here on the Tennis Podcast. He's the New York Times tennis correspondent. He said, "We're reporting today that Maria Sharapova is to retire," and he'd got an exclusive interview with her. That was followed within minutes by her own personally penned essay in Vanity Fair and in Vogue, explaining why she'd come to this decision and talking about her career and what had led to this moment and all of her happy memories, etc., and not so happy memories, although I have to say the doping suspension wasn't mentioned in the piece at all. But Chris is the man that broke the story, and the first thing I wanted to know from him when I caught up with him in New York, walking the streets of New York, which is a wonderful sound in itself. You'll hear all sorts of familiar New York sounds in the background. I wanted to know from Chris how he'd first come to know that she was about to retire.
Well, I think it seemed like it was going to be in the air, just watching the way things went in Australia. I didn't think the retirement was happening this quickly, and maybe in this manner, but I knew that it was sooner than later. So there's there's been some communication back and forth, and it became pretty clear that in the last 2 weeks that this was going to happen. From outreach from her, outreach from us, and she decided the way she wanted to do it was kind of clean and tidy in her point of view, and not do a farewell tour or a farewell tournament. And so she, through her people, asked me to come to New York Monday. Took the train down from my house near Boston and met her in New York downtown. Big conference table with a very nice carpet, which was, I think, important for anybody who remembers her news conference during the Meldonium thing, when she said if she were going to retire, I wouldn't be with not a very nice carpet in the room. This, I think this met that box standard. And we talked for almost 2 hours, and it was a great interview. And she was no tears, a lot of wincing, talking about the pain she's been in. I think I hadn't really realized to what degree she'd been struggling physically. And it was, you know, as she is, poised under pressure and very decisive and clean break, time to move on. But she did want to, I think, despite the initial appearances, she wanted to have a quality interview and a quality talk with a journalist to get the full perspective. And, you know, it was good we got that opportunity. I thought it was a good interview. And there's more to come. We're going to hopefully publish some more about it as the days go on.
Yeah, well, I've read the interview, and I highly recommend anybody listening to this to go and read Chris's interview in the New York Times with Maria Sharapova. It really does give that perspective about, I guess, the process of coming round to retirement. And we're going to see a lot of it over the next few years with all-time greats of this sport. We've obviously been following it ourselves from a British perspective with Andy Murray. When will that happen? We thought it had already happened, and he's given his most recent update about his physical situation and the battling against the dying of the light, isn't it? And how much more can you take? And Maria Sharapova, she was known for that, wasn't she? Just carrying on, working her way through, trying to get at that last drop out of herself. And I guess eventually it just got too much. I mean, that was a tough loss to witness against Donna Vekic at the Australian Open. It did feel like she'd got nothing left.
Yeah, and I think the conversations that were had after that with her agent, Max Eisenbud, and also with others in her team, I think they were very emotional. And I think that was kind of the theme. It's like everybody's kind of hoping that she would realize that she kind of pushed the body as far as she could, but she had to come to that conclusion herself, much as Andy Murray will have to when the time comes, or Roger Federer or Serena Williams or whoever it is. But I think it's, you know, in Maria's case, as you know, David, she was thinking of retiring before the Meldonium scandal broke and the Meldonium test happened. She was kind of on the verge. People went to her press conference about that thinking she was going to retire. And I think this actually prolonged her career because she wanted to prove a point to herself and come back. And she's a fighter. She was not going to be defined by that. But ultimately, because the way it worked out since the comeback, in a way, she was defined to some degree by that. But I really, you know, she makes a good point in the story, which is, you know, you talk about the impact of going off Meldonium. And she goes, you know, I've had problems with my shoulder since I was 21. I've been fighting injuries all along. So I think this is the culmination of a lot of years and a lot of monomaniacal focus on hitting tennis balls from the age of 5, 6, 7 years old at a very intense professional level. So this is the outcome. 32 seems almost young these days, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Where do you stand on the Meldonium subject in terms of how we will remember her? How will you remember her, given that incident took place and that she tested positive for it?
Look, it's certainly a blot on the copybook, no question about it. She made a mistake. You think, as professional as she is in so many levels, she should have known what was going on. She should have taken ownership of that and had the people around her to be careful about it. As we know, that situation hit a lot of athletes at that time. It was the first month. Communication was not ideal. My view of it is she made a big mistake. That's one of the ultimate responsibilities of an athlete in this era, is to follow the rules on doping. But I don't believe she's an intentional doper, and that's what the appeal panel found. And I think she's paid a high price for it personally, and also I think in her reputation. I mean, just today, David, on social media, when I posted my comments, my tweet or whatever, the news, and then the story to follow, you looked down at the comments, and half of them are doper, cheater, good riddance, off you go. That, to me, seems unfair. Seems too harsh. Yes, she can't be viewed the same way as somebody who never made a mistake like that. But I don't think she should be viewed as somebody whose whole career was a sham because of basically an administrative error. That's just the way I see it.
And in addition to that, if you look back over her career, you're going back over more than 10 years before then, when she burst on the scene, when we all remember it, 2004 Wimbledon, beating Serena Williams in the final. Now, that rivalry turned dramatically in the opposite direction. But when she initially beat Serena in that final, there'd been such hype around her for a number of years, hadn't there? I mean, what were your early memories of her and dealings with her?
Well, she was just this twiggy talent, you know, with just the heart of a lioness, really. She would just, after every ball, it was as if it were going to be her last. And no fear, swing for the lions, able to walk out against Serena Williams, who was really at one of her peak periods at that phase, number one seed, have been dominating the sport, and come out and handle that moment and just take it onto her side. And she did have the Wimbledon the year before, where she'd gone pretty deep. I think made it to the fourth round, if I recall, or maybe even the quarters the year before. So that was when she made her mark. But still, to do it at that level, she'd never been close to that kind of an occasion. And she just seized it, and there was really no artifice to it. And grabbing the phone, calling her mom. I mean, people thought it was a corporate move, but it was really more spontaneity. And I think people will say, well, she got to where she got because of her looks. She made all the money because of how she looked and how she managed herself. There's some truth in that. But you can't forget the breakthrough moment was that match. 17 years old, young girl, basically beating the world's best player. That's part of the reason why she was able to use that platform and use that leverage. It wasn't all about the looks.
Well, when we look back at that match, I was watching the match point of it, and Catherine Whittaker and myself were just talking about that moment and how different she comes across, not just obviously the way she looks because she was only 17, but her reaction was felt so natural, and her demeanor over the years changed. I mean, maybe that's inevitable when you just get older, but it felt as though that was a different person almost back then, as somebody who just hadn't gone through the process of becoming an international superstar. Did you sense the changes that took place with her?
Yeah, she became, I think, much more, aside from the grunting or shrieking, whatever you want to call it, and that externalization, much more internally centered, I think, in a lot of ways, and showed a lot less. And I think, listening to her talk on Monday, I mean, I think a lot of the last couple of years, if you're looking at matches from that time, she's been thinking about her body a lot during the match. Am I literally going to be able to get through this match? And if I do get through this match, how am I going to get to the next one? And gosh, my shoulder hurts. And gosh, my forearms might lock up at any moment. I mean, I literally think her internal dialogue was like that in the last year and a half. And that's just tough. And that's got to make you look different in your body language and your whole approach to the game.
How good was she, Chris? Because she won all four, including two French Opens, which, if you go back, particularly to 2007, when she described herself as a cow on ice on clay, seems remarkable, doesn't it?
I asked her about that quote yesterday or Monday, and she said, you know, I really own that quote, and I think I'm a kind of a cow on ice other places too. So she has that nice sense of humor. She really does have a good wit. It can be used for evil as well as good, but she's definitely got a wit on her. But I mean, the way she plays in some ways is limited, David. Let's face it. I mean, she's not a natural volleyer. She's nowhere near as speedy a player as a lot of the top players are today. She's limited in terms of her ability to push forward quickly and change directions. Certainly on clay she was. But I felt that she made the most of her game, and she knew how to really, once she had you locked in from the baseline into a pattern, she knew how to finish you off. And she was just a relentless Nadalian point-by-point competitor. But for me, the peak of her tennis, in terms of when I thought she was really at her best, was that 2008 Australian Open, a long time ago now. But I thought that she, with her shoulder then still pretty healthy, she was really starting to dominate with her serve at 6'2". The ground strokes were strong. She was probably at her quickest at that point. And I remember watching that tournament when she won and thinking, boy, she could dominate for a while now. She's going to take the mantle from Serena and run with it. And then the body didn't let it happen, and then Serena revived, and some younger players came along as well, so it didn't work out that way. But
you
at her best, she was formidable. Yeah.
You coined the phrase, I believe, the unrivalry. between her and Serena Williams. And we talk about the 04 win she had in the Wimbledon final. She was awesome that day. And yet the record is 22. 20 wins for Serena versus two for Maria Sharapova. And you see them laughing and joking on the court after that, though. It seemed very nice in terms of the atmosphere between them. That changed pretty dramatically, didn't it, between the two of them?
Yeah. I mean, Serena's always aware of some people, in some cases, who piggybacks off of her. Celebrity kind of uses the upset over her to make their career. And I think she probably always felt that Maria, because of that day and the way that match played out. And I'm sure only Serena knows how well she was playing deep down inside of her. I think she probably feels she should have won that match. So I think she made Maria pay for, 15 years? And really made her pay at the U.S. Open last year. Remember that match, early round match, when she just destroyed her. So is that a fair reflection of their true skill sets and abilities? I don't think so. Would it have been lopsided anyway? Yes. I think if Maria, 2008 Australian Open time, would have played Serena at that level over a longer period of time, you would have seen a few wins from Maria. But she just locked her out. She rose to the occasion. Maria couldn't change pace on her, which can cause Serena some troubles, and wasn't able to. Her best thing in her later part of her career was her return game for Sharapova. And I think Serena's, one of her best serving days came against Maria, and just a lot of scar tissue. And that was kind of the one bit of kryptonite in her career, and she never could find a way to get past it.
What's she going to do next, Chris? Did you get a feel for that from the chat you had?
Yeah, I think she's got all kinds of plans. And as you know, she's somebody who has built these businesses on the side throughout her career. And she's had a couple of layoffs when she's been able to make time to really focus on those things, like her candy business, which she owns wholly and will try to focus on. I think she's told me she's going to go back and actually study architecture at the university level by the end of the year. And she's very interested in architectural design and going to do some work, I think, with designing and improving tennis facilities, much in the way you would a golf course.
Really? I mean, how'd you do that? How'd you improve a tennis facility?
I think you just take the design of all the clubhouses and everything else and give it an aesthetic feel.
Interesting.
She's going to certainly stay involved in Nike on that end with the design elements, try to be an input there. I think she'll have plenty of things to do, and she and her British boyfriend, Alexander, is very deep into the art world. He's an auction has an auction website, and I know he's prominently into that. That's big, and I think she'll also be there for her friends and her family in a way she hasn't had a chance to be.
Yeah.
But she's somebody who, for better or worse, and I know she's been criticized for this, has been really the ultimate compartmentalizer in tennis. She's come to the site, played her matches, not really connected with people because that was a way of, she thought, giving them an edge. Has kept her private life pretty damn private in a lot of cases, and I don't think she'll have any problem, because it was already compartmentalized, stepping into those roles. But she's a born competitor. I think she'll miss that adrenaline rush and that search for the best in yourself point to point, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you even look at the fact that she's announced her retirement in Vogue and in Vanity Fair, and obviously with yourself as well, but effectively away from tennis, really. And I just wonder whether tennis, aside from designing tennis facilities, whether tennis is going to see her again, because most players miss it. A lot of players find a way to come back into it. I wonder whether she will.
You know, I think you have to wait and see. I don't sense that's going to be the case in the short term, next few years at least, next couple of years, I would say. But then, it's a part of you. It's a part of you. It's all she's ever known, as she said in her first person essay today. And it's something that it's always there. You've always done it. So when the body heals, I really don't think she'll come back against a competition. I think that's done. But will she be back out there and have a desire to reconnect? I think I asked her about coaching and she laughed at me. So that's probably not going to be happening, at least in the near term, but playing a role in the business end of the tour or the business end of the sport, sitting in the stands and being part of that, I could definitely see that. It might take her a little while.
It'd be nice to think, I saw Billie Jean King saying some nice words about her on Twitter. It'd be nice to think she might want to make a difference in that regard, in as much as she's clearly such a powerful woman. She's built up such a brand of her own, and you wonder whether that might appeal to her one day, but I'm not sure it will.
I think you have to let them settle. You know, it's just too many years of intensity. She's been fighting her body for so long now. I'm sure she's disappointed that it ends this way. Because even though she thinks she gave it all, I'm sure this isn't the way she imagined it. Three first round losses in a row at the slams. Body not allowing you to express your craft the way you want to. I think, you know, you only really know when all that settles for a while and your own priorities bubble up. But there's a lot of things that'll pull her away from tennis because of her interests and her focus. But I think, you know, she told me she's not leaving because she doesn't love the game or competition. She's leaving because it's just gotten too heavy. Day-to-day and the heaviness overwhelms you after a while because you just, every day is such a struggle just to get on the court to even practice.
Final point, Chris, given you've spent a couple of hours with her, you've covered her whole career. You and I are at an age where we've covered players coming and starting in the sport and then leaving the sport. How, in a sentence or two, how will you remember her, really, as a tennis player?
A street fighter who looked like a model, I think, is probably what it comes down to. You know, she was really somebody who was a contrasting individual in that obviously the appearance was very bankable for her and it mattered a great deal in terms of her bottom line and had to take pleasure in it. But really, she was happy, covered in sweat, walking off the court, not looking her best after she'd had a good fight or being out there doing it, shrieking. Despite all the pressure to stop shrieking, she kept on doing it.
Well, I think that sums it up. Chris, as always, a pleasure, and a particular pleasure to speak to the tennis correspondent of the New York Times, walking the street of New York, in which we can actually hear people shouting at each other and horns going off.
7th Avenue, David. 7th Avenue.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Chris, as always.
See you soon. Bye. Thanks, David.
Take care. Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So there's Chris's story and version of events and memories, Catherine. He's been there following her career from day one and before day one in a way, because he was somebody who would have, you know, we get to hear about young players when they're coming through, particularly players like Maria Sharapova who get picked up by big management agencies. And I remember when I first heard of her, it would have been probably 3 years before she won Wimbledon. I remember interviewing her 2 years before at Wimbledon when she was just coming out of the juniors. And I think when she was having that run that Chris was mentioning at Wimbledon, I remember interviewing her and just being struck by how insistent she was and very clear in her mind that the goal was to be world number one. There was no fluffiness around any of it at all. She wants to be world number one, and that's what she went and did. It's quite a story all the way through, isn't it? But I don't think it's the story I necessarily would have thought it would have been when she ended up winning Wimbledon for the first time.
No, so much about her career is surprising for better and for worse. You know, that the only slam she won on more than one occasion was the French Open. That still blows my mind. That she never won another Wimbledon after 2004, but she won two French Opens. So much is surprising about her, and she fluffiness was what people wanted from her, wasn't it? It was, that was an act of defiance in itself. Tamaini Carriol from The Guardian tweeted just now an excerpt from a press conference of Maria Sharapova's from, I think it's Wimbledon 2003, because she was 16 and she was 17, of course, when she won in 2004. And she'd played, I think, a first round match against Ashley Harkleroad, a blonde young American. And it had been dubbed in the British tabloids as Battle of the Babes. I'll just leave a pregnant pause there. And the questions being fired at her, this was 17 years ago, which I suppose now I say it sounds quite long, but this is, you know, recent memory. She's persistently asked about filling the Kournikova gap. How are you prepared to fill the gap with Kournikova? How was it particularly special to win the Battle of the Babes? And Maria Sharapova's reaction to that was it special? What are the biggest difficulty with having certain looks and certain ability to keep concentrated on the sport? And she's just so confused by the question. Like, obviously, I have no issues with being concentrated on the sport. That's my number one thing, being focused and concentrated. And she's persistently bombarded with these questions about her appearance. And yes, I know that you touched upon with Chris that she didn't necessarily flee from that side of her perception, and she certainly profited from it and exploited it to a certain extent. But she did it on her terms. And when a woman is attractive, the world, hopefully less and less so as time slowly ticks on, but the world wants to value that in them above anything else. And she kind of said, I feel like throughout her career, she said, well, okay, I'm attractive and I'll make money from that if I can. If you want to pay me money to be attractive, then that's fine, I'll embrace it. But that doesn't define me. That's not what I am. And I have a lot of respect for that, a lot of time for it, and it's significant.
Yeah, the transcript to which you refer from that press conference is really jarring. I mean, particularly now, I think. I'd like to think that if I'd have seen the same transcript, whatever that is now, 6, 17 years ago, that I would also have found it jarring. But I don't think I would have found it as upsetting as I do now. I would be a pretty appalled. I don't know. Just talking to her, she's a child, not a child, but a teenager at 16. I just hated seeing those questions written down in that way.
But it wouldn't have been appropriate to ask those questions to an adult athlete there to talk about their sport. But it's all the more uncomfortable that she was 16, and from the word go, that's what people wanted her to be. And she said, no, I'm going to be what I want me to be.
Hmm. Yeah, the career that she's had, it's I think in a way she was unfairly paralleled as well with the emergence of Roger Federer winning Wimbledon the year before. And maybe it's only myself who thought this at the time. When she won Wimbledon, the way she won it, absolutely thrashing Serena Williams, the all-time great Serena Williams, at the age of just 17, I thought, we've got a multiple Grand Slam champion who's just going to win double digits slams at that age. I thought, well, if she can beat Serena like that at Wimbledon, I would never have imagined that she would have only won one more match against Serena Williams in her whole career. That would have seemed preposterous to me, the way she handled Serena that day.
One of the observations I found most interesting from your chat with Chris was actually about Serena Williams and how much it riles her when people make their mark by upsetting her, by beating her, by that because it struck me, we both watched that same video of Match Point from Wimbledon 2004, and we were both struck by similar things, the completely unfiltered unguardedness of Maria Sharapova, which you also asked Chris about, but the warmth of the embrace between Serena and Sharapova. Serena immediately doesn't hesitate to come over to Sharapova's side of the net to embrace her really warmly and say a few words. But I found that, I mean, of course it makes sense, knowing what we do about Serena, but I did find that interesting that Serena, from that day forward, before any aggro had taken place, just the very fact that beating her had been a defining moment for Maria Sharapova, that Serena Williams had been the victim of that defining moment, sort of set them against one another, set Serena on a course to make sure that Sharapova never got the better of her again. Of course, she did later on that year at the end of season championships. That was her second victory over Serena, and then never again, which is unreal.
If we put aside her Meldonium suspension for a second, which I will come on to you in a minute, because we covered that in depth at the time and on multiple occasions when she initially revealed that she'd tested positive, then when she had the book thrown at her, and then when she was subsequently returning to the sport and given a reduction in the ban. And so we'll deal with that in a second, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about her career and her approach to the business and to the sport of tennis generally, and her refusal. And I think this probably comes back to what you said about how she wasn't prepared to just go along with what people maybe wanted her to be. And she's just done it her way. And it hasn't always been that popular with, I don't know, maybe people within the sport, maybe with us in the media. And I just wonder whether that's something that might only happen to a woman. I don't know whether because she wasn't prepared to just toe the line, if you like, and she is, and this retirement a perfect example of it. I'll do it in Vogue and in Vanity Fair my way. I'm not going to do your nice farewell tour. You're not going to give me your crystal vases and all the rest of it. You're going to just have it my way. In my words, you're not going to get your press conference. You're just not going to have it. I don't care. And I feel like she's basically carried her entire career like that, with a bit of two fingers up to everybody.
Yeah, you're right. Non-compliance, non-conformity are not characteristics that society values in women. I went to a talk last night, involving three prominent feminists, one of whom has just released a book called Difficult Women. Helen Lewis, the author of the book, discussing significant what society might call difficult women in feminist history and how they've been treated, and as a result of that obstinacy, the difficult facets of their character that enabled them to do extremely significant things, but also led them to be treated in a certain way by a society that didn't embrace those qualities in women. So I think there probably is something in that, and that's something I'd not really considered before with her. And you know, I had issues as much with her subsequent treatment of her post-ban career and approach to it, and approach to attitude towards it all, I suppose. I had as much issue with that as I did with the whole fiasco that unfolded at the time. But I do respect the attitude of, I'm just going to do this my way. And there's a lot of people who are talking about Kyrgios today, and how he was saying after retiring in Acapulco, he kept on saying, I don't care that I got booed, whereas actually you could tell he very much cared, the way he was talking about it. I think Sharapova really managed to do a lot of genuine, I don't care.
And Sofia Kenin, it's some of the things that we were raving about her in Melbourne, really, that she just stomped around and did her own thing. And she idolised Maria Sharapova. That was her hero. And I don't think I quite realised that over the years, if I look back over Sharapova's career, it was kind of a bit unusual to not embrace it in the way that maybe people wanted to do, in your words, but to just forge her own perception. I mean, I've never liked the Sharapova product and things like that. I don't particularly like some of the things that she's carved out for herself as another career. But that's just a personal preference. I have a lot of respect for the fact that she's just gone and, well, just done what she wanted to do, and she's successfully done it. Just before we get back onto the ban, I mean, the on-court achievements are, whilst they're not as spectacular as I thought they were going to be from her as a child prodigy, as somebody who came along as a junior champion, etc., I find her achievements arguably even more impressive, given that we subsequently, as Chris was mentioning, found her to be kind of limited as a tennis player, actually, and yet she still, through perseverance and through just bloody mindedness, because she would not quit, and she adapted and found ways. I mean, look at how she won her slams. 2004, I think it was 2006 for the US Open, 2008 for the Australian Open, 2012 for the French Open, 2014 for the French Open. You know, she's done it over a 10-year period and still only won 5 slams, but won all of them. I mean, I quite like that when I look at that as a body of work, with all the injuries as part of it.
Yeah, and with a game that's now quite out of date, isn't it? The tennis has moved on from that high powered weaponry, but with major limitations, style of play. You can't really afford to have the limitations that she has in today's game, and that's been the case over the course of her career. She's been fighting against the tide, and as you say, it's her bloody mindedness. And even I can't remember exactly when it was, when she had a period away and she came back with a remodeled serve. She'd had to change her service motion, and she was double faulting a lot, and you looked at her play and you thought, well, without her serve, she doesn't stand a chance. You know, if she's not holding serve with ease, she can't afford to not have that weapon removed from her game, and she just wasn't having it. She just found a way, and that's to her great credit.
How tainted for you, therefore, is she by the doping suspension? Because I listened back to the podcast we did around that time, and the story, you know, it did change. It became more severe when the initial ruling came out and gave her a 2-year ban and said that she had full control over what she was doing, and then it was subsequently reduced by the Court of Arbitration because of saying that it wasn't intentional. But then you look at the fact that she would never let us know what she'd replaced Meldonium with, given that Mildrenate, as it was called in her initial words, was something she needed for a medical condition, and we were never allowed to know, well, okay, how are you treating that medical condition, and the possibly circumstantial evidence that she never got close to those achievements subsequently to having been unable to have that substance.
How tainted is she? I think that's in the eye of the beholder. For me, and I'm very aware that this might be, in fact, is unfair, but for me, she's more tainted by my knowledge that she was legally doping for all those years than she is by the, as Chris put it, the administrative error, which I suppose you could say that's slightly reductive, but it is essentially what led to her testing positive and receiving that ban. I know that's unfair because, heck, they might all have been taking meldonium. Every tennis player out there might have been taking meldonium their whole careers up until the point that it was added to the banned list. And she's the only one that's been exposed for it. So I'm aware that's an unfair position for her to be in, and it's unfortunate. But I'm really uncomfortable with it. I'm uncomfortable with, even though I know it goes on, I'm on the cynical end of the scale when it comes to doping, sadly. You'll be surprised to hear David's probably on the more optimistic end of the scale. I'm not naive about how much that's probably going on, but it still depresses me and disappoints me. So as unfair as it is,
the system thing,
that's what sticks in my mind. And it, that's for better or worse, that's what sticks in my mind. How about you?
Yeah, I still don't know for sure whether she's telling the truth about the fact that she just needed it for a medical condition and maybe it had no positive effects to her performance. It's just it's impossible for me to know about that. But then I do look at that circumstantial evidence, at the very least, the before and after. And I know that she will say, no, it's about injuries. My shoulder was falling off and therefore I couldn't play. But it was a pretty dramatic drop-off. When you look at the fact that she won the French Open in 2014, she reached Grand Slam finals in the year after that. Then she tested positive, stopped having it, and she got nowhere near that level afterwards. Now, that may just be circumstantial, but it does bother me. I think it was Andy Roddick in an interview. He said, and I know he's a friend of hers and a supporter of hers, but he did say, look, it was legal, so she can do what she likes, but it does look as if it was helping. I remember him saying it in that way. So that will always bother me when assessing her career overall. But at the same time, I think maybe with the years, I'll think back to some of the many good moments, not only that arrival on the scene, but more the perseverance, more the reinventing of herself, more the fact that she got four slams, all four slams.
For me, her biggest achievement was beating Simona Halep in that 2014 French Open final. If you ask me to pick out a career-defining tennis, on-court tennis moment, it would be that. She had no right to be winning the French Open in the year 2014, as you say, a decade after her first slam, beating, you know, Simona Halep had emerged that season. She was the absolute informed player. Okay, it was her first Grand Slam final, but all Sharapova had on her side in that was her doggedness and her experience, and she made those count for more.
And I did like the fact that the way she went about her business on court and off it, there was never a stone unturned. And people did like to the tabloids and various people in the media, I think, and trolls do like to point the finger and say, oh, she was, you know, this glamour all the rest of it. But it was just, I mean, it's okay, maybe on the side that she was interested in that side of things as well. But God's sake, there was never a second when she didn't give everything. There was every last drop that she had to give put into her career to try to just make the most of it. And I thought I enjoyed watching that. I enjoyed that side to her as a competitor. So, you know, we're going to get a lot of these over the next few years.
This is the only one we're doing twice.
It's the only
I'm
one
saying
we're doing
that
twice,
now.
Folks. Yeah, it is indeed.
You don't want any more false alarms.
the career of Maria Sharapova is at an end, and it does feel out of the blue. I mean, the way she's done it, I am taken aback by. I didn't really expect this, but then maybe I should have done.
I hadn't given it much thought because in my mind this was absolutely coming at some stage soon. I hadn't given much thought to specifically how it would happen, but she doesn't strike me as a hugely sentimental person at all. It doesn't surprise me at all that she's not wanted to have a farewell tournament or a farewell event, even, you know, just to do a victory lap. Thinking about her character, that doesn't surprise me really. And as you observed, it is interesting that she's done it outside of the tennis sphere, really, aside from the chat with Chris.
Perhaps quite enjoyed that element of it. I think she's probably quite enjoyed saying, yeah, screw you all.
Definitely.
I'm gonna do it my way. So Maria Sharapova, her career is at an end. It's been best part of two decades long. And, well, we wish her the very best in her future. And it'll be interesting to see whether she does return to tennis in any meaningful way at all. I'm not convinced she will. No shout-outs on this particular show because it's a bit out of the blue. And we've got no Matt to remind me. But we will say hello to Butler. Hello, Butler.
Any excuse.
Mascot. Yeah. And we'll be back with normal service resuming on Monday.
You could have just made up a load of names for shout-outs there.
Could have done, yeah. Just any old guy.
Or just do shout-out to your mum and dad.
Hi, mum and dad. Hi, Catherine's mum and dad. Hi, Catherine's brother. Hi, Rosie. Hi, Magic.
And you said there were no shout-outs.
Well, there you go. They all deserve it, you see, part of the team. And we'll be back on Monday. So thanks for listening and speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.